Crises and tragedies continue in Gaza and Israel, and that's the news. This episode is part of our Middle East series, in which, next week, we'll have a scholar guest to talk about the history of Palestinians. In this episode, my guest shares with us the fascinating stories of the Jewish diaspora.
You're on a limb, but you're exactly right. I'll give you, there's one great story about that, is Charlemagne. Charlemagne wanted to make a treaty with the king of Persia, because Charlemagne's adversary were the Byzantines and the Persians were on the other side.
Yeah.
So Charlemagne, they had no language in common. So Charlemagne included in his diplomatic entourage to the king of Persia a Jew who we simply know as Israel the Jew, who went and helped make that treaty because he spoke Hebrew to a Persian Jew. From a 20th century point of view, Ashkenazic Jews are sort of the center and the leadership of world Jewry. But this wasn't always true. For much of Jewish history, Ashkenazic Jews were the upstarts on the stage. They were the newcomers. The reason the focus on Spain is, first of all, its duration. Jews lived in Spain, well, really, at least since the 700s CE, when Spain was conquered by the Muslims. Muslims invited Jews to Spain, and it lasted until 1492. That's 700 years. Just by comparison, Jews have been in America for 350 years, or a little bit more. So Jews who lived in Poland, this is their origin story of why Poland is called Poland. Now, the Hebrew word for Poland is Polin. And if you break that into syllables, the Hebrew phrase Polin means let us dwell here. And so, Polin had the connotation of this is the place where Jews live. Jews are not allowed to own land or farm. That was an older Christian idea. The economics I was talking about is, you know, Jews had the keys to the church. And if the church didn't meet some obligation, the landlord would send Jews to lock the church up. Yeah, remember, this is in the name of a very powerful Polish landowner. These weren't rights that Jews possessed themselves. They were just the agent of these rights. But after a certain point, the difficulty of converting to Judaism increased. So in traditional Judaism, if a person wants to convert to Judaism, they're going to be refused three times before they're allowed to convert. And this, I don't mean pro forma.
Did you know that there once was a large and powerful Jewish state north of the Caspian Sea? This medieval Jewish kingdom of Khazar was formed when its king converted to Judaism, and it is believed to have lasted for some 200 years. But then, for reasons that have so far eluded historians and archaeologists alike, this Jewish kingdom vanished into history. Hey there, news peelers. No, you're not wrong. Today is not Friday, which is the publication day of our weekly podcast for the past three seasons. This is the first episode of our midweek program. So today is Wednesday, November 1st, 2023. And this is Adele, your host at the History Behind News podcast. Aren't you tired of the repetitive news on TV and social media? They just go over the same dramatized developments all day long. Do you ever wonder what happened before our news? I mean, how do we get here? They say if you don't know your history, you're bound to repeat it. So while others cover the news, I uncover its history. I call this peeling the history behind news, which we accomplish in weekly conversations with distinguished scholars who delve deep into history to give us their fascinating perspectives from our past. I'm committed to making in-depth history that are researched and written by scholars enjoyable and accessible to everyone. So grab a cup of coffee, or your favorite drink, or both, and let's get into it. Two weeks ago, in Season 3, Episode 40, Dr. Michael Petlick told us the founding history of the Jewish people. For example, from what point in history did the Jewish people identify themselves as Jewish? And what was their land called then? The land in which they lived. When did Jews form their first polity in that land, their first country? When did they adopt Judaism as their religion? And when did they leave that land? And that's where I pick up the story in this episode with my guest, Dr. Howard Lopovich. The story of the Jewish people after they left this land that encompasses modern-day Israel. As Dr. Lopovich tells it, most of Jewish history occurred outside of their homeland, and most of Jewish culture and religious practices were formed and solidified in the diaspora. As we watch interviews of Israelis about the tragedies that occurred on October 7, we see many different faces. Some look European, some look Middle Eastern, some look African, and there are some who even look Central Asian. So my question is, how did this vastly varied people, dispersed throughout the world, keep their Jewish identity for some 2,000 years? Regardless of geopolitics and however you feel about the current war between Israel and Gaza, this is an amazing story that merits telling, especially now. And Dr. Lopovich tells it superbly. He's a professor of history and the director of the Cohen-Hadot Center for Judaic Studies. Dr. Lopovich specializes in modern Jewish history, specifically the Jews of Hungary and the Habsburg monarchy. He recently completed a history of the Jews of Budapest and is currently writing a history of the Neolog movement, Hungarian Jewry's progressive wing. He's the author of The Translathanian Paradise, a history of the Budapest Jewish community, 738 to 1938. To learn more about Dr. Lopovich, you can visit his academic homepage, the link for which is provided in the detailed caption of this episode. So, stay with me as Dr. Lopovich and I peel the history behind this news.
We hope you are enjoying this podcast. And if you are, then why not treat us to a cup of coffee? That's right. For the price of a cup of coffee, you too can become a monthly supporter of the History Behind News podcast. We rely on your support to continue this program, to continue peeling the history behind our news. Supporting us is easy. Just click the support link in the detailed caption of this episode. And while you're there, check out the information about our guests and other attributions and links. And thank you.
Dr. Lopovich, it's a pleasure to have you on our program. Thank you for taking the time for this conversation with me.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get too deep into the long history of the Jewish diaspora, let's address some basics here. For example, what's the difference between Sephardic and Ashkenazi Jews?
That's a great question. There's a couple of differences. I think it comes down to one genealogy and the other culture. So Ashkenazic and Sephardic, first and foremost, these are terms that refer to different parts of the Jewish diaspora. So Ashkenaz is a, I would call it an old Jewish term or maybe a medieval Jewish term for Germany, like German Central Europe. And Sephard means Spain. So both of these names appear in the Bible in a different context. And eventually Ashkenaz was understood by Jewish commentators of the Bible to be Germany and Sephard to be Spain. So first and foremost, they Ashkenazic and Sephardic refer to Jews who come from, in the case of Ashkenazic, they come from not specifically Germany, but let's say German, Eastern and Central Europe.
So that's a good point because from time to time I speak to people of Jewish people and they say they're Ashkenazi and they're not German. They may be Polish. They may be Latvian.
Well, yeah, Ashkenazic Jews started in Germany, but beginning around the 1300s, there was a large-scale migration of German Jews eastward to Poland and to the Baltics and to Ukraine. So that large Jewish community that was in Eastern Europe, that was Russia, Western Russia, Poland, Ukraine, the Baltics until the Holocaust, that community was largely Ashkenazic because their ancestors had originally come from Germany.
Okay.
So similarly with Sephardic Jews began in Spain, but there was also a Sephardic Jewish diaspora. So after the expulsion of Jews from Spain, Jews from Spain moved many places, including many parts of the Ottoman Empire. So there are large Sephardic communities in Iraq, in Turkey. Today, most Jews in Bulgaria are Sephardic. So first of all, it means where you come from. The other difference is there are cultural differences between what it means to be a Sephardic or an Ashkenazic Jew. So both, I would say 90% of what it is to be Jewish, certainly Jewish ritual, is the same. Keeping kosher is more or less the same. Observing the Sabbath is the same. The calendar is the same. The liturgy is mostly the same. But there are subtle little differences in liturgy and in practice. The main difference, though, is in a kind of outlook, because on the whole... Outlook. On the whole, Ashkenazic Jews... Because Ashkenazic Judaism, as Ashkenazic communities, began in a Christian context that was less hospitable to Jews, Ashkenazic Jews tended to be more, let's say, warier of the outside world and outside ideas than Sephardic Jews, because Sephardic Jews began in Spain at a time when Spain was much more hospitable to Jews. So I put it to you this way. Typically, if you walked into the home in the Middle Ages, let's say, if you walked into the home of an Ashkenazic Jew, and you looked at the bookshelf, the books are going to be only Jewish books, the Bible, the Talmud, books written by rabbis, Jewish philosophy, Jewish literature, Jewish poetry. If you walked into the home of a Sephardic Jew, you would see all of those books, but you would also see books that weren't specifically Jewish books, philosophy, literature that wasn't Jewish. So Sephardic Jews tended to be a bit more worldly than Ashkenazic Jews. Not that Ashkenazic Jews were entirely closed off, but they were more closed off, more insular than Sephardic Jews.
Dr. Lopovich, I started this podcast by telling you that let's get some basics out of the way. There's nothing basic about what we're talking about. This could be a podcast onto its own. Wow, that's fascinating. You know, in our initial talk, when we were chatting before we started the program, I mentioned to you that I had read a book relatively recently, like 2-3 years ago, by Amos Oz. And in there, I learned about Yiddish and how it sort of dominated the spoken language of the Jewish people over Hebrew. So how did this happen?
That's a great question. Well, it's two things. First of all, for much of the history of the diaspora, Hebrew was not the day-to-day spoken language of the Jews. Hebrew was the language of prayer. Hebrew was the language of rabbinic discourse. But for a spoken language, Jews typically, in some cases, they spoke the vernacular language of the land, like most American Jews speak English. But more common, where Jews live, they created a Jewish dialect of the vernacular language. So Yiddish began as a Jewish dialect of medieval German written in Hebrew characters.
Oh, wow.
And as Ashkenazic Jews moved elsewhere, so for example, when Ashkenazic Jews moved from Germany to Poland, they brought Yiddish with them. And so Yiddish became the language of Polish Jews as well.
So would Sephardic Jews speak Yiddish?
No, Sephardic Jews, they had their own, they created a Jewish dialect of, well, I should back up and say that when Jews lived in Muslim Spain, they created a Jewish dialect of Arabic called Judeo-Arabic, which was Arabic written in Hebrew characters with some Jewish words put in. That one actually began in Baghdad. But later, when Jews lived in Christian Spain, they created a Jewish dialect of Spanish called Ladino.
So
is Judeo-Spanish written in Hebrew characters. So Yiddish is for Ashkenazic Jews what Ladino is to Sephardic Jews.
This practice of adopting a vernacular of their own religious language, in this case Hebrew, is this particular to Judaism particular to that time in Judaism? Because now, Jewish people they just speak English here in America. And I apologize if my sort of question is way too simple and naive.
No, not at all.
And I'm wondering if Christians did that, create a Latinized version of their local dialect. I don't think that was the case though, right?
Well, Latin became for Christians their language of prayer.
But they kept their local languages like English, French, or whatever Danish it was. But this is really fascinating.
The difference is that Christians were typically the majority.
Jews were
a very small minority. So for Jews, the choice was between embrace the language of the majority, vernacular language. But the concern was, and this is a concern of a minority of people, you want to do things that preserve your own, the integrity of your community, that can help you preserve your identity as a small minority. And these Jewish dialects were one of the things that did that. Plus, they enabled Jews to live both in a larger world. So there was a connection to the vernacular language, but they also had, Jews have always had a deep love of Hebrew. So even a language like Yiddish, which is not Hebrew, or Ladino, which is not Hebrew, there are a lot of Hebrew words that have entered Yiddish and Ladino.
I see.
In Yiddish, the word for the Sabbath is not the German word for the Sabbath. The word for the Sabbath is Shabbos, which is an Ashkenazified version of the Hebrew word Shabbat. The Ashkenazic word for a holiday is Yontif, which is Ashkenazified version of Yom Tov in Hebrew.
That is fascinating. So they get to keep their community, preserve it by creating a language that's still tethered to Hebrew, which brings another, again, I apologize if this question is also way too simple. Why not just speak Hebrew then?
Great question. Hebrew was always defined as Lashon HaKodesh. It was a sacred tongue. It was for sacred purposes only, and sacred in Judaism and prayer and the study of sacred text. And day-to-day life was deemed not sacred, but mundane. So even in ancient times, when Jews lived in Babylonia, they didn't speak Hebrew. They spoke a Jewish version of Aramaic. So probably not since biblical times, when Jews lived in the land of Israel, did Jews actually use Hebrew in day-to-day life, because it was eventually deemed as a sacred language. It's only in the modern world, one of the things that Zionism as a secular Jewish identity introduced into the world was the revival of Hebrew as a language of day-to-day life. And part of that was that Zionists, being secular Jews, were not tethered to that notion of Hebrew as a sacred language. Hebrew became a national language instead.
Which I suppose meant that they had to create new words and terms.
Absolutely. But in particular, there was the early Zionist thinker who really invented Hebrew as a modern language was a man named Eliezer Ben Yehuda. Uh-huh. He became a Zionist very early on, already in 1890. And he was a believer that Zionism, it wasn't enough simply for Jews to leave the diaspora, create a sovereign homeland and a state, that Jewish culture had to be reinvented so that Jews who were losing interest in religion would still have a way to identify and have a full Jewish identity in life. And he believed that a modern spoken Hebrew would be the key to doing that. And so what he and his wife began doing in the 1890s is they began to speak only Hebrew to their children. And they were the only Jews anywhere in the world, even in the land of Israel, who were using Hebrew that way. And it was extraordinarily difficult. I mean, there was a time, that one of their children didn't speak for the first several years. And he and his wife were freaking out a little bit that this experiment was going to have disastrous consequences. But it eventually worked. And to answer your question, yes, they did have to invent new words. There was no Hebrew word for tomato or socks or train. They had to invent these words. Now, they had something to draw on, because there were medieval dictionaries of Hebrew, but these were using older words, mostly words associated with scholarship and poetry and prayer. But yes, they did have to invent a lot of words.
That is fascinating. You shared with me the interest, actually the necessities more than an interest, of preserving their own culture in Europe because they were the minority, which made me think of this kingdom in medieval era, the Khazars, which was in north of the Caspian Sea, and it was a Jewish kingdom? I'd love to learn this history.
Well, long story short, I mean, the Khazar kingdom in Central Asia, like you say, north of the Caspian Sea, the story is that these were basically a people who were pagans, and some point in the 8th or maybe early 9th century, the king of the Khazars, and the Khazars presumably, converted to Judaism. No one 100% exactly knows why, other than the fact that Judaism was an ancient religion. I guess it had its appeal that way. But there was this Jewish kingdom in the middle of Central Asia, in the Middle Ages, which sort of came out of nowhere. And eventually that they were discovered especially by Spanish Jews. You know, there was a Spanish Jewish traveler whose name was Benjamin of Tudela, who traveled all over the Jewish world and visited Jewish communities everywhere. And he had heard rumors about the Khazars, and he went to visit them. You know, there was also a Spanish Jewish poet, philosopher named Yehuda Halevi, who wrote a story about the king of the Khazars. He was writing this philosophical text. He's trying to defend Judaism against its critics, but also explain why he felt Judaism was the superior religion. And so he made up a story called The Khuzari about the king of the Khazars, in which he imagined why would this pagan king choose Judaism. So it's a series of philosophical dialogues. And in these dialogues, the king of the Khazars, first he wants to become monotheistic. So first he's visited by a Christian, and then a Muslim, and then a philosopher, and then a Jew. It sounds almost like a joke. Four philosophers go talk to the Khazar king.
Go into a bar, right?
Yeah. Right. And in each one of these dialogues, he asks questions, and he finds flaws in the arguments by the Christian, Muslim, and philosopher as to why theirs is the superior life. But it's the Jewish scholar who is able to convince the king of the Khazars about the truth, the rationality, the compassion of Judaism. And in Halevi's version, this is why the king of the Khazars becomes Jewish. But in reality, we don't know exactly why. We just know that he did. The kingdom lasted for a couple centuries. And then by around the year 1200, it sort of disappeared. So it's sort of there, and then it's not there, and no one knows exactly why.
Wow. Okay, let's
yes.
Let's peel away that history just a little bit. First of all, when you say it started in the 8th century, so this is somewhere in the 700s. Islam is a new religion. Christianity has become, by then, 300-400 years, the official religion of the Byzantium, Roman Empire, and then many parts of the world, most of southern Europe. And this certain, was he a king or a head? Or head of a tribe. I use that word for the nomadic people of the steppes, right?
Right. Probably both. He was
probably
the king,
both
head of a tribe. I mean, that it's probably, there was probably some, you know, they were a tribe that had a certain territory. So I would say both.
So ethnically speaking, what sort of people were they? Were they Turkic people?
Turkic, Central Asian, you know, we don't 100% know that either, but they were associated with one of the Central Asian peoples today. I mean, they could have been who's ever in that region, Kazakhs, Uzbeks, whoever are there. But something Turkic, something Central Asian.
There's semi-nomadic people up there, so back then. So I'm not sure if this question applies, but let me ask it anyway. Did they create texts and scholarships that remain?
Not really.
That's just really wild.
What I've told you about them is most of what we know about them.
Wow.
What's known about the Khazars is mainly about in connection with their becoming Jewish. There's just not much more known about them.
Have any archaeological projects occurred over there, happened over there to dig and see? I'm very fascinated by this.
Yeah, I'm not really a maven on the archaeology of it, as far as I know, I don't think archaeologists, they find, you know, sometimes they find things that might be connected. There's speculation, supposition, there's circumstantial evidence, but I don't think they've really found anything more definitive than the story we have so far.
Okay.
And certainly they haven't found any more about why they became Jewish. We just know that they became Jewish.
That's really interesting. And this is, there's no doubt about this. This is factual. This is like confirmed history.
As far as I know.
Yeah.
As far as I know.
As I was preparing for my conversation with you, Dr. Lopovich, I came across this extent, this current Jewish autonomous obelisk that was created in the Soviet Union, Soviet era, and still exists. It's like the only other Jewish jurisdiction in the world than Israel, right?
Yeah. I mean, this is another very interesting story. Now, it takes place in a similar part of the world. It has nothing to do with the Khazars. This was a weird experiment or project by Stalin in the 30s in a region known as, or a province known as Birobidzhan. So Stalin had a large Jewish number of Jews who lived in the Soviet Union, many of whom had previously been Polish Jews or Russian Jews. And many of them by the 1930s had embraced parts or all of the ideology of the regime. These were Jews who were good Soviet citizens. But there was this notion that, you know, Stalin, unlike Lenin, who believed that national identity was an impediment to true identity, was something bourgeois, Stalin had a sense that some aspects of national culture could be preserved. I mean, him being Georgian, not Russian.
Yeah.
And so he did try to a limited extent to allow national minorities, including Jews, to cultivate some sense of national identity. And that eventually led to this project or this experiment. He took the province of Birobidzhan, which is on the border of China. It's very, very
way far out east.
Way, way east. And he basically redefined this as an autonomous Jewish province. He said, Jews, go and create a Jewish province or a Jewish province of the Soviet Union in Birobidzhan. Now, the first thing you have to say is that Stalin wasn't only doing this out of any concern or interest in Jews. His primary concern was probably much more strategic, where he wanted on the border of China to have a population in an area which was largely unpopulated or underpopulated. He wanted a larger population of loyal citizens,
people
who were loyal to him as a buffer against any kind of Chinese expansion into the southeastern part.
But when you say loyal to him, I was just intrigued by this. This is in southern Siberia, way out there. I mean, did Russian Jewish people, Russian Jews, did they embrace this?
I mean, most did not.
Okay.
That community, there were more than a million Soviet Jews. It was a large Jewish community.
Yeah.
Maybe 20,000 went there. That's what I say. This was an experiment.
Yeah,
a little bit more, but it's in the tens of thousands.
Yeah.
Some went. They were offered land. They were offered, a good life. They were basically, if you wanted to get away from the government and not be hassled, you were far from Moscow and St. Petersburg. You were living in an area that was basically the Wild West. It was way out there. But it was also the promise of, he said, Jews who live there, Soviet Jews who go and live there, you can basically run your own affairs. And the language of this province was going to be Yiddish, because Yiddish already in the Soviet Union was one of the national languages that was allowed under in the Soviet Union. So, for example, Hebrew in the Soviet Union was largely not allowed. Hebrew was considered a national language. Zionism as a movement was not allowed in the Soviet Union. It was a national movement. But Yiddish was considered to be the local identity, and it was considered to be compatible with a Soviet identity. So even, a decade or more before Birobidzhan, Soviet Jews were cultivating a kind of Yiddish culture. It was secular Jewish culture in Yiddish, but oriented around the ideas of being a Soviet citizen. So it was basically, the goal was to teach Soviet Jews what it meant to be a Soviet citizen, or the way one person described it is, to bring the ideology of the Soviet Union to the Jewish street. And since most Soviet Jews still spoke Yiddish in addition to, or only, and didn't speak Russian, Yiddish was a great way to reach a lot of Jews. And so for Yiddish-speaking Jews who wanted a sense of, a sense of Jewish agency, but were not interested in Zionism, they could go to Bir Obidjan and be part of this weird Jewish autonomy experiment all the way in Bir Obidjan.
And still exists.
It still exists. I mean, it still exists. The signs are still in Yiddish. I wouldn't say it's anything terribly significant.
Yeah.
I mean, as national Jewish movements go, this one was much more a footnote, certainly.
Yeah.
Compared to
I perceive it as such. It was just really interesting when I
It's an interesting little story.
Yeah. For sure. And we'll be back after a short break to talk about Jewish diaspora in Europe. We'll be right back. In this episode, Dr. Lopovich talks about the long history of the Jewish diaspora in Persia. But is it Persia or Iran? And are they Persians or are they Iranians? Dr. Lopovich also mentions the Sassanid Empire, which is also known as the Sasanian Empire. In 614, the Sasanian Persians conquered Jerusalem from the Christian Byzantium Empire. And guess what? Jews fought along Persians in that battle for Jerusalem. The Sasanians were a mighty empire. They beat Rome in many battles and killed and captured Roman emperors, which sent shockwaves throughout the Roman Empire and caused instability. So here's my question to you. If the Sasanian Persians were so mighty, then how did their entire empire crumble before the Muslim Arabs, who were then upstarts from the Arabian Peninsula? The conventional answer is that the Persians exhausted themselves in a 25-year-long war with Byzantium. So when the Arab Muslims arrived on the scene, they were able to take advantage of that weakness. But one of my guests, Dr. Khodadad Rezakhani, completely disagrees with that history, and he explains his view based on his research on how it was that the Persians succumbed to Muslims, an event that opened the Middle East and Central Asia to Islam and completely changed world history. Dr. Rezakhani also answers our initial question. Is it Persia or is it Iran? Are they Persians or are they Iranians? And he answers this question by drawing analogies to Germany, of all places, right? I've dropped the link for you to my conversation with Dr. Rezakhani in Season 3, Episode 11. Now, let's get back to our conversation with Dr. Lopovich. Dr. Lopovich, there is a lot of history about Jewish people, the diaspora in Spain. Why Spain? Why not Italy, Greece, or France?
Well, I mean, all of these are important diaspora Jewish stories. So, I mean, the diaspora is a very long history. The diaspora begins in the 500s BCE, in Babylonia.
Yeah.
Persia were the original diasporas. The focus on Spain is, first of all, its duration. Jews lived in Spain, well, really, at least since the 700s CE, when Spain was conquered by the Muslims. Muslims invited Jews to Spain, and it lasted until 1492. That's 700 years. Just, oh, wow. Just by comparison, Jews have been in America for 350 years or a little bit more. So first of all, it's duration. But secondly, these were Jewish communities. I mean, this is a Jewish story where Jews really thrived for much of that 700 years. Not all of it was good. There were some serious setbacks, and obviously it ended with expulsion. But there were long stretches of time when Jews really flourished in a lot of ways, you know, especially the period under the Muslims until the end has often been referred to as a kind of golden age for Jews in Muslim Spain in terms of political stability, in terms of economic prosperity, in terms of the flourishing of Jewish culture. So it's really one of the most successful and durable diaspora Jewish communities in the history of the diaspora.
And from there, according to one of your colleagues, Dr. Pitlick, many Jews went to the Ottoman Empire and other parts of,
other parts. Yeah.
In the last segment, when we were talking about Yiddish and you talked, you know, we started with Germany, and you talked about migration of Jews also to Poland. It's a country that I wanted to speak with you about because I've come across the history of the Jewish people in Poland, a large presence. And I want to ask you why. Why Poland in Eastern Europe, even before Russia?
It's a great question. It's a great question. Well, first and foremost, it was a question of proximity. You know, there really weren't very many Jews in Poland, let's say, before the 1300s. Jews who lived just west of Poland were in Germany. Their conditions were deteriorating. The conditions were getting tough.
And in Germany.
In Germany.
Okay.
And in Poland, the leaders of Poland, the aristocrats, the king, they recognized the benefits of having Jewish subjects. So they invited Jews to come to Poland on very favorable terms. So Jews went to Poland, first of all, to get away from the difficulties of living in Germany, of medieval Germany, but also because there was real opportunity there because, for example, they could live there by paying fewer taxes, having fewer restrictions. Part of the reason that these Polish sovereigns did that is that Poland was at a point, especially in the 1400s and the 1500s, it was expanding. It was expanding, especially to the east. So there were these large areas that were underpopulated, and they wanted people, I mean, anyone, to come and settle. This is the situation of a frontier. When you have a frontier, one of the things you want is you want to attract people there. And I would say it's one of the truisms of Jewish history is that in a frontier situation, conditions for Jews tend to either be exceptionally bad or exceptionally good. And in this case, the conditions for Jews were exceptionally good because the powers that be needed Jews to be there. They needed to have people settling. They needed to have subjects who were loyal, and they needed to have subjects who could perform certain economic tasks.
So, first question, it's really a clarification more than anything. We're talking about Poland. At this time, it was more like the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, kind of like that big empire.
It was becoming the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. Yeah. So the Kingdom of Poland begins to expand, while the Duchy of Lithuania is also expanding. And in 1569, the two basically combined to become the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, which was the largest, I would say the most powerful state in Europe. It extended eastward into Russia. It extended westward into what is today East Germany, included most of Ukraine. And that's where most Jews in Europe lived for a long time.
Wow, that's fascinating. And most people don't talk about the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. Most people don't even know about it. Was this Commonwealth and its predecessor, just the Polish kingdom, were they considered, I used this term in my prior communications with you, more liberal with a small L in comparison to other European kingdoms at the time?
I think liberal would be the wrong word. I would say either religiously tolerant or religiously neutral.
I see.
Religiously tolerant, meaning, you know, Poles were Catholics, and Catholics have very strong and clear views on Jews. But the Polish powers that be were willing to set aside their Catholic attitudes towards Jews for the practical benefits of having Jewish subjects.
Yeah.
So the status of Jews wasn't dictated exclusively by Christian theology, which could tend to lead in a more negative direction.
Of course.
But it was tended to the needs of settlement and in the needs of economics and the needs of loyalty. So they were more pragmatic. And that sort of, I wouldn't say it set aside, but it downgraded or downplayed the influence of being Catholic, in this case, in formulating attitudes towards Jews.
When you talked about sort of economic needs and reality of having a kingdom, in this case, having people settle in the frontiers of the Polish kingdom, later the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. So that means that owning land and farming was part of the Jewish life.
And Jews are not allowed to own land or farm. That was an older Christian idea. The economics I was talking about is, the real novelty there is you had these large Polish landowners, oftentimes either they were absentee landowners or like they would live in Warsaw or they would live in Krakow instead of some remote area, or they couldn't live everywhere on their estate at once. So they needed someone to be an estate manager, and they needed someone they could trust, and they needed someone who wouldn't have aspirations to rise in revolt or to challenge them. And Jews were perfectly suited for all of those things. So Jews were hired by the large Polish landowners as the estate managers of the estates. So they were put in charge of assessing and collecting taxes. They were also, as estate managers, given a special license to brew and sell liquor. So they would also be the tavern keeper, which was a big, big privilege, because the production of liquor at this point in time was becoming much more lucrative. I mean, long story short, what the large agriculturalists, large Polish landowners were discovering, that it's much more difficult to lug wheat or barley to market to sell it. It's much easier to distill it into liquor.
Yeah,
that to market and sell, because you can make a lot more money and have to transport a lot less. So Jews were basically given license to do that. And this was a lucrative source of income for a lot of Jews, although it did put them eventually in a precarious position between landowner and peasant.
Yeah,
and you can imagine from the vantage point of the peasants, if they regarded their landowner, their landlord, as being oppressive or as being unfair in some way, they didn't have any direct relationship with the landlord. The representative, the messenger of the landlord, was the Jewish tavern keeper. And there were situations where that became not only precarious, but also destructive and lethal to Jews.
So at times, if they wanted to take out their anger on the policies of an absent landlord, the person that was in front of him was a Jewish administrator.
Exactly.
And
the Jewish superintendent, basically. Yeah. Instead of going after the owner of the building, you go after the Jewish superintendent
who lives on the premises. Now, in administrating, that means they also collect the taxes, and they sort of controlled production and all of that. They told people what to do. Is that
Well, they didn't tell people what to grow. They didn't tell farmers what to grow, but assessing and collecting taxes, that is a big deal.
That's
a big part of life. But for example, also, you know, Jews had the keys to the church. And if the church didn't meet some obligation, the landlord would send Jews to lock the church up.
Oh my gosh.
So, I mean, remember, this is in the name of a very powerful Polish landowner. These weren't rights that Jews possessed themselves. They were just the agent of these rights.
That must have rubbed people funny.
If you imagine a situation where peasants who tended to be less educated, more parochial, more prone to Christian ideas towards Jews, if you combine that with this kind of economic-based resentment, they could become very hostile. Now, the worst instance of that was when you go further, far enough east in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, in what's now Ukraine. The peasants were Ukrainian, and the peasants were also Orthodox Christians, whereas the landlords were Polish and Catholic. So there was an additional layer of resentment and hostility. So that's the point where it was in Ukraine in the year 1648, where that tension between Ukrainian peasants and Polish landlords erupted in the form an uprising against the Polish king and the Polish nobility, but also it turned into a massacre of Jews led by a Ukrainian Cossack whose name was Bogdan Khmelnytsky. So it's interesting because Khmelnytsky in Ukrainian history is a hero. He's like Simon Bolivar or George Washington.
Wow.
You know, if you go to Kyiv today, in the middle of the city, there's a huge statue of him. He's a great national hero because he was trying to liberate Ukrainians from foreign rule. And from the vantage point of the Poles, he is this Ukrainian rebel trying to destroy the Polish kingdom. From the vantage point of Jews, he led a massacre. So, for Ukrainians, it's the Ukrainian national uprising. For Jews, or the Khmelnytsky national uprising. For Jews, it's the Khmelnytsky massacre in 1648 and 1649. And many Jewish communities in southeastern Poland were destroyed during these massacres. But it grew out of that particular economic relationship and social relationship.
Yeah.
As the middlemen between two groups that were often at odds with one another.
That is fascinating, tragic, and very complex. I asked you about Poland and Spain because these two European countries really interested me, and I knew a little bit about their histories. Is there another country that in particular interests you that you want to share with us in the diaspora experience of the Jewish people?
Well, I think every diaspora Jewish community is interesting. I mean,
yeah.
I would have to say, the American Jewish diaspora is a fascinating story. I mean, this is the most recent. And I would say by the 21st century, the American Jewish community is challenging Spain and Poland as the most prosperous and successful Jewish community.
Yeah.
Some ways. I mean, the story of Jews in America, and there are always setbacks. And right now, the American Jewish community is experiencing this upsurge of anti-Semitism. We're experiencing a setback right now. But for the most part, most of that 350-year history has been more positive than negative. So, you know, if we measure a kind of golden age by political stability and economic prosperity and cultural flourishing, the American Jewish community, certainly by the 20th century, is definitely an example of that. In some ways, it's fundamentally different than other ones, because America as a country is the first country built on the principles of the Enlightenment. But it's a remarkable one. But if you're asking me for another older diaspora Jewish community, well, if I had to choose one other, I mean, the one that fascinates me is the Persian Jewish community. Because it's so old. You know, there was it's really in some ways the original diaspora Jewish community. It goes all the way back to the 6th century BCE.
Talking about Iraq and modern Iran.
Modern Iran and parts of Iraq. Yeah, okay. Exactly. You know, there was a book written about 10 or 20 years ago about the history of Persian Jews. It's called Esther's Children. Esther being Esther, Queen Esther from the Bible.
Oh, wow.
See themselves, not literally as her heirs, but that story goes, the history of Persian Jews goes all the way back to the time in which that biblical story is set. So the longevity of it, now it had its ups and downs. There were periods in the history that were extremely difficult. In some ways, it's remarkable that it survived. But, you know, they have a sense of distinction. So there are all these Jewish dialects. Persian Jews have their own. They created a Jewish dialect of Persian, not Arabic, not any other language. They have a culture that's very distinct. But I think also, maybe because they've been around so long, Persian Jews really, they're maybe the closest thing to Jewish royalty in the diaspora.
I mean, Oh, wow.
There is a regal sense to them. They really have a pride in their own Jewish culture and the longevity of it. The fact they've been able to preserve it for so long that I would say in a healthy way, they look down on other Jewish communities, above all on Ashkenazic Jews. Because, you know, if the Persian Jewish diaspora is the oldest Jewish diaspora community, Ashkenazic Jews are the upstarts in Jewish history. Every other kind of Jew in the world, Jewish community, predates the Ashkenazic community by at least a few centuries. So it's a strange situation, because in the 20th century, the largest Jewish communities in the world were Ashkenazic, in Poland until the Holocaust, and in America. And Ashkenazic Jews were also played a major role in building the State of Israel. So from a 20th century point of view, Ashkenazic Jews are sort of the center and the leadership of world Jewry. But this wasn't always true. For much of Jewish history, Ashkenazic Jews were the upstarts on the stage. They were the newcomers. You know, if I was going to make a sports analogy, I'd have to make it to the New York Yankees, because, you know, I grew up in Detroit, so I grew up rooting for the Tigers. I was an American League fan. But when I got to college, I met people who rooted for National League teams. And I didn't know that the National League in baseball is 25 years older. So they always refer to the American League as the upstarts, because, you know, we came later. So the New York Yankees are the greatest baseball team, because they've won more World Series. But from the vantage point of a National Leaguer, we're still the upstarts.
Oh, and wow.
Ashkenazic Jews are kind of the New York Yankees of the Jewish world. So there was a tendency for a long time, not only by Persian Jews, but by other Jewish communities, to look at Ashkenazic Jews as sort of, you know, the bottom of the barrel, the dregs, with the, you know, the least impressive of Jews in the world. And it's only much later that Ashkenazic Jews rose to this level of prominence and leadership in the world Jewish community.
I wanted to ask a quick follow-up question and then share a personal story with you. First, the follow-up question, did the lot of the Persian Jewish community change after, I think it was 632, no, perhaps it was in the later 600s, when Islam toppled the Sasanian Empire, the Second Persian Empire, and Iran effectively, and Iraq over 200-300 years became Muslim?
It's a great question. It's a complicated question, only because the Sassanid Persians had a kind of love-hate relationship with Jews. The later years of that Sassanid Persian Empire were not that great for Jews. So initially, Islam brought a reprieve for Jews because Islam tended to be more tolerant of Jews. The whole Islamic concept of the dhimmi, the protected people, was much preferred to the Sassanid definition of Jews, which tended to be less tolerant, in the same way that Islam was a reprieve for Jews living in Byzantium and other Christian places. But from that point on, so originally it was definitely an improvement, but then there's this ebb and flow in the Muslim world, more and less tolerant. You know, Iran eventually became Shiite, and Shiite Muslims were sometimes less tolerant of Jews, though certainly not always. So there was this brief reprieve, and after that, there was a kind of ebb and flow, really depending on the larger mood of the Muslim world.
The Muslim world also has
fluctuated from being more tolerant of non-Muslims and then less tolerant of non-Muslims.
And I told you I would share a personal story, and here it is. I was born in Iran, and like most Iranian Americans that left Iran after a revolution, so did my family. I've been here since I was young, and then one of my very good friends is Jewish, but from Iran, and I've spent a lot of time with his family. I never knew that they had a certain dialect. They just spoke Farsi, and I'll have to look into this. This is really interesting.
Well, they speak Farsi and they have Judeo-Farsi. They have both.
Yeah, I'll have to ask about that. Yeah, that's really interesting. We'll be back after a short break to talk about conversion to Judaism and host countries of the Jewish people. Hey there, News Peelers. We're working on a brand new website with many super duper features, including videos of our guests and compilations of our episodes into series, with related blogs that are updated weekly, like series on U.S. politics, economy, health policies, environment, women's rights, and also series on many other countries like Russia, Ukraine, China, and Brazil, and the British monarchy, and also a series on revolutions and protests, like those in Iran, Israel, and France. So be sure to check it out at historybehindnews.com. See you guys there. Dr. Lopovich, how important was conversion to Judaism in the Jewish diaspora?
Oh, important is an interesting choice of words. I think...
I guess I meant important to growth of the population.
I think the growth of the Jewish population was mostly through biological growth. Jews were never really counting on converts or new members to grow.
Okay.
They were counting on two things. They were counting on having children, and they were counting on retaining the children and the people they had. So those were their main concerns. In fact, after a certain point, I mean, conversion to Judaism was always possible. But after a certain point, the difficulty of converting to Judaism increased. So in traditional Judaism, if a person wants to convert to Judaism, they're going to be refused three times before they're allowed to convert. And this, I don't mean pro forma. If you go and you want to convert to Judaism, you ask a rabbi or someone, the answer is going to be no. And the reason for that, and like I said, this is not just pro forma. The reason for that is Jews don't want converts unless they really mean it. They don't want half converts. They only want people who are with real conviction and real sincerity. And they don't want people converting to Judaism for the wrong reason. So, for example, I don't know if this is an urban myth or a real story, in that there was an individual who wanted to convert to Judaism because he bought into the conspiracy theory about Jewish power. I heard Jews control everything, so I want in on that, so I want to become Jewish. Now, I don't know if that's a real story, but it illustrates the point. That person was turned away. If you want to become Jewish, you have to demonstrate that you really believe in the ideas and values of Judaism. Now, once you do that, then there is a process you can go through, although that process is also very rigorous. You can't become Jewish overnight. The first thing you have to do is to study for an extended period of time. And once the person working with you is convinced or is satisfied that you have a thorough enough knowledge of Judaism, then you can go through the actual ritual of conversion.
This is interesting because in some ways, the way you're explaining it, this rigorous process and this true, true desire to become Jewish, in some ways, some of these converts may actually know the Jewish religion and culture more than some people that are born Jewish, right?
Absolutely. Converts to Judaism. I would say that's not just sometimes. I would say oftentimes converts to Judaism are more knowledgeable about Judaism and more active and committed to Judaism than many Jews who are born Jewish, who just for them, it's just sort of secondary, who may do nothing, who may be indifferent. You know, indifference is not an option for a convert.
Yeah. Did a lot of significant incidents of conversion to Judaism occur in history? We talked about one of them, the Kingdom of Khazars.
Right.
Yeah.
I would say it was more, first of all, we don't have a lot of records about it, but I mean, when it would happen, especially if it was a public figure, it could be almost scandalous, you know, the Middle Ages, in medieval France or maybe Spain in the 8th or 9th century. There was a Christian clergyman whose name was, we simply know him. His name was Bodo. He converted to Judaism. He became known as Eliezer. And the Bodo-Eliezer affair was a real scandal in the church. This was the point where the church, especially in France, began to lobby to have greater separation between Jews and Christians because were concerned that Christians were being attracted to Judaism. I'll give you another example. You know, in the 13th century, the mendicant friars, meaning the Franciscans and the Dominicans, they were concerned mainly with a decline in Christian piety in Christian Europe. But one of the things they attributed that decline in Christian piety to was too much interaction between Christians and Jews. So it wasn't necessarily Christians converting to Judaism, but it was Christians being, you know, well, being distracted by Jews or being attracted to ideas other than ideas that are Christian. So there are always people converting to Judaism. We don't know how many. I don't think it was ever really that many. There was never a massive, other than the Khazars, I suppose, there was never a massive wave of converts to Judaism.
I see. So it wasn't a significant development in the history of Jewish diaspora. You know, in narrating Jewish history in the nations, kingdoms, and empires in which they lived during the diaspora, we often come across the term, especially in scholarship, host country, right? Mm-hmm. But for the Jewish people that lived there, for example, in Spain, you said 700 years. The term host has sort of a temporary connotation to it, but for them, this was life. This was permanence itself. So how did they view their host country? And I'm wondering, what term did they use?
That's a great, great question. I would say, especially in longer diaspora experiences like Spain and Poland, Jews really had a sense of rootedness and being at home in these countries. Now, there was this belief, there was a core Jewish belief that at some point in the distant future, at the end of time, far in the future, the Messiah of the Jews would arrive and lead the Jews back to the land of Israel. But that wasn't an immediate concern. Most Jews who live in the diaspora felt very much at home where they were, And they believed that that's where they were going to stay. And that was their experience, because you'd have multi-generations of a Jewish family who not only lived in the same country, but would live in the same town or the same village for multiple generations. And so there was a real sense, this is where we've been, and this is where we're going to be forever, or at least till the end of time. So they had a deep connection to where they were living.
Okay, so they didn't use the term host or anything like that. That's modern scholarship that refers back to those times.
Yeah, but they didn't use the term specifically, but they did have a sense that this was their home. I'll give you an example. You know, different Jewish communities, they'll create sort of an origin story. So Jews who lived in Poland, this is their origin story of why Poland is called Poland. Okay. The Hebrew, basically, it's a story about people who are, about a group of Jews who are wandering around looking for a place to live. Now, the Hebrew word for Poland is Polin. And if you break that into syllables, the Hebrew phrase Polin means let us dwell here. And so, Polin had the connotation of this is the place where Jews live. This is where we are. This is where
we belong. This is fascinating.
And in fact, it's remarkable. You know, I mentioned earlier, Jews in Poland suffered that setback in 1648, that massacre by the Ukrainian Cossacks. In 1648, there were some Jews who thought Jewish life in Poland was over. In fact, there was a Polish Jew whose name was Nathan of Hanover, who wrote a eulogy for Polish Jewry called The Abyss of Despair. But it was premature because there were almost 300 more years of Jewish life in Poland. That's a long history. And even though Polish Jewry had a tragic end during the Holocaust, before that, this is a remarkable diaspora experience. What Polish Jews were able to do and create in a lot of different ways, this was a place where Jews lived comfortably, or at least in a stable situation, for a very long time. And they saw the Polish kings or the Polish nobles as their benefactors and as their protectors.
In here, we're talking about Polish Jews, and I appreciate what happened in 1648. And correct me if I'm wrong here. I thought what happened in 1648 was on the Ukrainian side of the Polish-Lithuanian Empire. But the way you're describing it now, it seems like the 1648 massacre was throughout the
country. I'm sorry. It was just in the Ukrainian southeast.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
But the notion was that destruction was going to have a seismic effect. It was really the beginning of the end.
Oh, I see.
Being able to live anywhere in Poland, even though it just started in Ukraine, because it was followed by a series of wars and a destabilizing situation. But the fact of the matter is, it was a temporary setback. And, you know, Jewish life in Poland and even in Ukraine went on all the way into the 20th century.
Yeah. Let's take a break here. Stay with me and Dr. Lopovich as we get into the perspective.
The History Behind News podcast is available on all your favorite podcast platforms. Of course, we love your reviews and ratings of our podcast, especially on Apple and Spotify. And remember, don't keep us to yourself. Tell a friend about the History Behind News podcast.
Dr. Lopovich, so we know about the tragic histories of persecution of the Jewish people and then the Holocaust. You mentioned them in the last segment. What other impacts and legacies has the diaspora had on the Jewish people?
That's a great question. That's a very, very large question. Well, it's interesting because most of the history of the Jews is a diaspora history. You know, the first 1,000 takes place in the land of Israel. But really, after that, I mean, from 586 BCE, the first time Jews were expelled from Jerusalem and the temple was destroyed, the majority of Jews in the world will live outside of Israel. But yet, even though diaspora becomes a center of Jewish life, Jewish creativity, the Jews never lost a connection to the land of Israel. So first of all, wherever Jews live in the diaspora, the land of Israel, even though it wasn't a Jewish state, even though most Jews didn't live there, was still this focal point for Jews all over the world. And it was also a point of connection. So you had Jews in different parts of the diaspora, even though they didn't have much connection to each other, the connection to them as Jews was they shared in common this deep shared connection to the land of Israel, to the Hebrew language, to things that emanated from there. But that aside, much of what is Judaism was created by Jews in the diaspora in a very diaspora situation. So I'll give you an example. You know, in ancient Israel, the principal form of prayer was sacrifice at the temple. But in the diaspora, they didn't really have sacrifice. So in the absence of sacrifice, they created personal prayer as the way to talk to God.
Oh.
And they invented the institution of the synagogue as a surrogate or a replacement for the temple, which was too far for them ever to visit. So they always had this connection, but they had to adapt Judaism to a very different situation. And so things like that in Judaism really reflect the fact that Judaism had to be reinvented. I'll give you one other. You know, in Judaism, long story short, there's this notion of holiness in Judaism, sacred, things being special, so to speak. And in the Jewish concept of holiness, there's holiness of space and there's holiness of time. So certain spaces are more sacred than others. The land of Israel is more sacred than the diaspora. Jerusalem is more sacred than the rest of the land of Israel. The Temple Mount is the most sacred space in the world. So there's a hierarchy of holiness of space. But holiness of time means like the Sabbath is more sacred than the rest of the week. So what you have when Jews move to the diaspora, they still have this very important concept of the holiness of space. But in the diaspora, in the absence of this accessibility to the temple in Jerusalem and the land of Israel, holiness of time takes on greater importance. So the Sabbath in the diaspora becomes just of paramount importance for preserving a sense of Jewish identity and Jewish community. You know, the way one Zionist in the 20th century, there was a Zionist thinker whose his name was Asher Ginsberg. He went by the pen name Achada'am, and he made this observation. Now, he was a secular Jew. He didn't really observe the Sabbath, but looking back through Jewish history, he said, more than Jews kept the Sabbath kept the Jews. The fact that Jews around the world were doing the same thing on the same day, or if you were a Jew traveling anywhere in the world and you needed a place to observe the Sabbath, you would just go to the local Jewish community. So it's in the diaspora where diaspora Jews created this uniformity or these connective ties between Jews everywhere. For a really long time, a Jew from anywhere in the world could walk into a synagogue anywhere else in the world and be able to follow the service, participate in the service, even lead the service, but have a full sense that he or she was fulfilling the obligation of praying in the synagogue. Or even more profoundly, what was read from the Torah in a synagogue was exactly the same pretty much everywhere in the world on Saturday morning.
So
uniformity there.
Jewish traveler, let's say merchant, let's say we're back in 1725, I just picked a year.
Yeah.
Going from, let's say, outside London to somewhere in southern France, and that person goes to a synagogue. It's not only sense of connection, but they immediately find a community, right?
Immediately.
Let's say that English person from the Cotswolds or Bath going to southern France, they're fish out of water. There may find some English people there, but there's no community in southern France or western Poland for them.
Or in the Middle East or North Africa or in Central Asia. And it's beyond just finding a community. If you had, you know, all you have to do is you could speak a little bit of Hebrew, even just from the prayers. If there was a local Jew who could speak Hebrew, you had a language in common. Hebrew was this language around the world, even though it wasn't the spoken language, where if Jews really needed to communicate, they could use what Hebrew they knew to communicate with what Hebrew the locals knew. Even though they had different vernaculars, different dialects, you know, Yiddish, Ladino, whatever else, Hebrew was this common thread. But the synagogue service, the calendar, the life cycle, Dietary restrictions. You could find a place where you could find kosher food. A local Jewish family could give you food that you knew you could eat.
This also smoothens relationships for all sorts of stuff, including trade and business and even diplomacy. I don't know, maybe some kings in the past would have their diplomatic corps include Jewish people so that they could communicate. I'm going on a limb here, but...
You're on a limb, but you're exactly right. I'll give you, there's one great story about that, is Charlemagne. Charlemagne wanted to make a treaty with the king of Persia, because Charlemagne's adversary were the Byzantines and the Persians were on the other side.
Yeah.
So Charlemagne, they had no language in common. So Charlemagne included in his diplomatic entourage to the king of Persia, a Jew who we simply know as Israel the Jew, who went and helped make that treaty because he spoke Hebrew to a Persian Jew. That's how they got over that seemingly insurmountable language barrier.
Wow. Dr. Lopovich, I'm going to make an executive decision at this point of not asking 10 more questions on this specific subject. Otherwise, we'll be here for hours. If you wanted our audience to remember just one point about the Jewish diaspora after everything we've talked about, what would it be?
Great question. One thing about the diaspora. I think to understand the diaspora, you have to do two things at the same time. You can't reduce the experience of Jews in the diaspora to simply adversity and persecution, even though there were recurring moments. There were long stretches of time where Jews, you know, had actually had a very stable situation in the diaspora. But at the same time, you don't want to sugarcoat the diaspora. The fact that Jews, as a minority people, were able to survive this long in this many different places through this many challenges, and this variety of challenges, is truly remarkable.
Dr. Lopovich, thank you so much for educating me and our listeners. And to our listeners, if you know of any history that could provide more perspective from the past on this subject, please share with us and tell us what's your perspective. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
The opinions and statements of our guests are their own. We neither agree nor disagree with them. We're only interested in the perspective they provide through history. At History Behind News, we're honored that our guests share their expertise with us, most of which are based on years of scholarship and research, and we provide links to their projects and publications for your benefit to review them if you wish. Otherwise, we're not affiliated with our guests. We just think they teach us pretty cool history, the history behind our news. Also, unless we explicitly inform you, we're not affiliated with any institutions, including Amazon, for which book links are shared here from time to time for your convenience. Finally, as a reminder, we don't do news here at History Behind News. We peel the news for the history behind it. And our mission is not to provide a complete account and analysis of the past, rather is to highlight some issues and incidents in our history that may poke and prod your discerning minds into seeking some perspective for our news. And if you disagree with our take on history, well then, it means we've succeeded in getting you to think about the history behind news. And of course, share your thoughts with me by leaving your comments on Twitter or sending an email to adele@historybehindnews.com. I love to hear from you. I love to learn from you. Until next time, this is Adele with History Behind News, a history podcast for our news.